4 degrees in Kenosha, 33 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning the program with a issue of crucial importance, the opioid crisis, the opioid epidemic, which right now is so serious that opioid overdose is the leading cause of death in adults 18 to 45. That is a staggering fact, difficult to take in. It's one of many facts shared in a fascinating new book called Ending the Crisis, Mayo Clinic's Guide to Opioid Addiction and Safe Opioid Use. It is the work of several people at Mayo, but chiefly Dr. Holly L. Geyer, who is a hospital internal medicine physician and addiction medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona. And among other things, she leads Mayo Clinic Arizona's Opioid Stewardship Program, which works for the safe dispensation of opioids. And we will talk about all that this fascinating new book encompasses, which everybody needs to be looking at. As you might guess, it's published by Mayo Clinic Press, Ending the Crisis. And Dr. Holly Geyer, we welcome you to the morning show.
What a privilege to be with you.
I have to say that for as much as I have followed the issue of the opioid crisis, I still found a lot of what is in your book staggering. I mean, I really did not fully comprehend the dimensions of this crisis or the fact that it's touching, in a sense, every corner of the United States. I mean, this is not just a big city epidemic nor a rural America epidemic. It's really, in a sense, everywhere and touching on so many lives. But it's important, I think, for our listeners to understand that your book is about much more than just the dimensions of this crisis. Your book, in so many respects, is also crafted as a vision of hope, of real possibility of stemming this. Tell us about sort of the attitude with which you shaped this book.
Absolutely. This book is about empowerment. You know, for many years now, we've been addressing the opioid epidemic within the medical community, at the federal level, from a regulatory standpoint, with state laws. And despite all of these major interventions, especially those taken around that 2016 to 2018 timeframe, we've seen worsening of our crisis. Opioid overdose deaths were up 30% in 2020, up another 15% in 2021. Who knows what this last year will show? Clearly, the efforts thus far are insufficient to get us out of this crisis. And we wrote this book to really be a change in mindset. As opposed to us as Americans being passive consumers of the third-party interventions that are coming from the government, from our physicians, from outside entities, let's be equipped with the knowledge necessary to make informed decisions ourselves. This book is derived from information across our enterprise to make sure that every patient knows how to use an opioid safely if it's prescribed. Is it right for them? How to have that conversation with their doctor? What alternatives are available? How to store it safely and how to avoid their toxicities? The latter half of the book is written to empower patients and family members to take action if and when opioid use disorder, also known as addiction, ever becomes an issue. So how to find a treatment program, how to navigate the medical system and insurance system, and then ultimately things to watch for.
The foreword of the book is by former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams. And one of the things that I really appreciated about the sort of the tone of his foreword, which I think is also a reflection of the book that follows thereafter, is when he says that, you know, despite the acute severity of this situation, we know so much more now than we have ever known about addiction and specifically addiction related to opioids. And while there are, of course, still escalating deaths, the resources and tools for combating it are more available than they have ever been before. So in a sense, there really is reason to hope if we can just kind of galvanize people to understand that and get people who need this help connected to that help.
It's so true. And, you know, the unfortunate reality of the epidemic is that we've been treating this, the whole topic of opioids, as opioids being the enemy, when in reality, it's our misunderstanding of them that's the true enemy. And, you know, but when that gets out of control, how to deal with the consequences. And unfortunately, less than 10% of people struggling with opioid addiction ever get the treatment they need, despite it being more often than not widely available in communities and with the advent of internet, available online now even. So yes, there is absolutely hope, and we need to make it tangible.
Your book at the outset presents three stories of opioid addiction. And so somebody named Joyce talking about her own mother, somebody named Penny talking about her son, and then someone named Charles, who happens to be the uncle, or I'm sorry, the cousin of the singer Prince. Three different stories of opioid addiction. And I suppose that's really important because we all need to understand that there are many different faces to this particular epidemic. And that's maybe a little bit different from other kinds of crises involving the use of drugs. This is something that by its very nature has seeped into, in a sense, every facet of American society, not just what we kind of think of as the classic profile of a drug abuser or a drug user. Opioids have, in a sense, snuck their way into so many people's lives.
It's so true. You know, we've got in our minds what the average drug user looks like, and I think many of us picture someone homeless on the street with a needle in their arm. The data shows that between 9 and 20%, according to the American Medical Association, of people that are receiving an opioid could develop long-term dependency to the drug. And you don't need any specific risk factors to develop it. It can happen to anyone. That's what makes this crisis so personal, is that moms and dads, you know, businesswomen, people that do struggle on the streets, all have the same kinds of risks of developing opioid use disorder or addiction. There are things that place you at higher risk, but no one's immune, and that's why it's key to have this information in every household in America on what to do if it develops.
Right. At one point in the book, you say, we wrote this book because our world has been fighting the wrong battle. And so by trying to, in a sense, create a much higher level of understanding about opioids, what they are, how to use them safely, how to prescribe them safely, we can really maybe get a new handle on this program. In the chapter called What Went Wrong, Chapter 2, you outline, in a sense, how we got here. And we don't have time to explore all of that in detail. But one of the things I learned about in this chapter is what you call a now notorious 100-word letter to the New England Journal of Medicine back in 1980. You call it the match that sparked a forest fire. What was the misunderstanding shared in that letter to the New England Journal of Medicine that, in a sense, set so many other wheels in motion?
Yeah, so the New England Journal of Medicine is one of our most high-profile journals on the market. And back in the 1980s, they published this very brief clinical report where they had studied thousands and thousands of patients at a hospital system and only found a handful. It was just a couple of people that ever had the diagnosis of addiction for individuals that had received opioids during that time frame. And they used that on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry and the federal government to widely populate the myth that use of pharmaceutical-grade opioids doesn't lead to addiction. We couldn't have been more wrong. You know, that was not a well-done clinical study. This wasn't great level of evidence for us. And we in the physician world should have been much more responsible at looking at this critically and saying, is this article truly saying what we think it's saying just based on the information they've reported. I think it was just one of many articles to come out during that time frame, which set the mindset inappropriately that opioids should be given liberally for pain as opposed to scrutinized for the right population.
Mm. Among other things, your book talks at one point about what you call the dueling demics, that is, this opioid epidemic, and then what happened to it with the COVID-19 pandemic. Briefly, what was it about the COVID-19 pandemic, which is not by any means over and done with at this point, but of course, we are in a sense through the worst of it, but in that crucial, critical phase early in the pandemic, what was going on that, in a sense, exacerbated what was going on with the opioid crisis?
Two words, access and excess. You know, poor people who had been struggling with chronic pain problems and getting good relief with therapeutic procedures or access to their pain team for other types of non-opioid therapies were now cut off from the medical world as we were dealing with COVID. People couldn't get appointments, and they turned to alternative agents for pain management, oftentimes being opioids. I think these were given out liberally in many healthcare systems, and the data shows the longer you're on an opioid, the more likely you are to become dependent on that drug. At the same time, we have this devolving mental health crisis in America. People are shoved at home. They've lost their income. They're with other loved ones who may be struggling with addiction themselves. And all of this access of mental health problems and availability of drugs within the household really set off a cascade of what we saw as a 30% increase in opioid overdoses across our country.
Mm. And that, of course, might be one reason why, even though we are beginning on all kinds of levels to take this very, very seriously, the number of opioid overdose deaths continues to rise. I appreciate that your book, among other things, takes the time to talk about pain, physical pain. Chapter 7 is titled Understanding Pain, which talks, among other things, about the value of pain, the protective feature that pain represents in many cases. Help us understand why understanding the nature of pain itself is one avenue to getting control of this opioid crisis and helping us understand opioids themselves and how to use them so much better.
Great question. You know, for the average American, we are a pull yourself up by the bootstraps type of nation. And, you know, I think there's a pill for that type of mentality is probably one of the reasons that we're seeing such a pain crisis in America. Pain serves a purpose, at least acute pain does. And that's the kind of pain you sustain with an injury or after a surgery. It helps us set limits. It helps define how the body has time to heal and what you're doing that's hindering that healing process. When we respect those bodily processes to help guide us and what we can and can't do, we hopefully will achieve shorter durations of pain and ultimately not have it transition into chronic pain, which is a disease in itself. That chronic pain, according to national guidelines, takes place somewhere between 45 to 90 days of ongoing pain, and that can be a bear to get rid of or treat effectively. So using opioids to target really the ultimate goal of this medication class, functionality, as opposed to eradication of pain, is going to take a mindset change in this nation, and that's one thing this book helps address.
Right. And your book goes on to talk about various means of treatment of OUD or opioid use disorder, including medications that can be a part of this. Your book also explores some of the issues that are involved when a loved one has opioid use disorder and how one can approach it and broach the topic. Create, in a sense, an intervention that's going to ultimately be effective. I wanted to ask you about the intriguing use of the word stewardship. You lead Mayo Clinic Arizona's opioid stewardship program. And I think that's a wonderful word that probably speaks to many aspects of how we can most comprehensively and effectively meet this crisis. Talk about us. Explain the way in which you are using the word stewardship in this context.
Yeah, so stewardship refers to kind of an overarching concept that honestly refers to all drug classes. The point of using any drug is to have the benefits outweigh the risks. And we've recognized with opioids that that balance has been surprisingly hard to achieve. With opioid stewardship programs, we're able to identify what patients are likely to benefit from our intervention. What are their baseline medical conditions that put them at risk for addiction or overdose? And how do we educate patients through this process to make sure that if they receive an opioid, they know other therapies to use as an adjunct with it, how to store the medicine safely, how to dispose of it, and then how to contact us if and when they start experiencing complications. All of those are holistic models of stewardship. And we believe at Mayo Clinic that that is the most important role that our institution can offer in ensuring that there's a safety net for our patients when an opioid is given. Hmm.
Of course, one of the things that has made this so complicated to confront is the fact that we're talking about a couple of different avenues in which one can become addicted to opioids. It can be when something is carelessly prescribed and then carelessly used and misused and so on. But then there's also this other sinister way in which one can become addicted to opioids, in a sense, outside of the realm of medical science altogether. How do we combat that facet of this?
Yeah, it's important to understand anyone is at risk for opioid addiction. Anyone is at risk for opioid addiction, and that's why we're seeing it in all walks of life, right? Moms and dads, homemakers, business professionals, all the way to people that are struggling with abuse on the streets, with bad lifestyles. When we think about opioid addiction, it's key to understand that everyone plays a role in identifying it early. And that includes the roads that come with this, right? Some people are taking opioid medications appropriately for chronic pain. As the body becomes more and more dependent on that drug, that can actually lead to patterns of misuse and abuse that will be evidenced as addiction. We also see people that experiment with it occasionally for entertainment purposes. And by the way, these drugs, opioids, are now lacing many other substances if you're getting them synthetically off the streets. So cocaine, heroin are often laced with fentanyl. Cannabis is increasingly laced. And now we're seeing even internet products for weight loss, for mood stabilization as being sent through the mail, now laced with fentanyl. A study was done that showed 42% of all these drugs that are laced with fentanyl contain enough of a dose of fentanyl in one use to kill a person. So it is not a safe era to be playing around with the illicit substances, for sure.
Right. You call it a problem that has no boundaries. Dr. Holly Geyer is author of Ending the Crisis, Mayo Clinic's Guide to Opioid Addiction and Safe Opioid Use. Thank you, Dr. Geyer, for giving this world this important book, and thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show Archives. I am sure many of you are acquainted with an absolutely riveting memoir out of the Gulf War called Jarhead, which was transformed into an equally riveting film starring Jake Gyllenhaal. The author of Jarhead and that memoir was Anthony Swofford, who has written a novel since then, and now a new memoir. A memoir at both different and strikingly similar to that first memoir, a memoir called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. In this new memoir, Anthony Swofford is not telling the story of that battlefield of Jarhead, but rather, in a sense, a different sort of battlefield, an emotional and mental battlefield, as he waged, in a sense, a real struggle to try to come to grips with his own father and their very, very difficult, painful relationship. Anthony Swofford's father himself was a veteran of the Vietnam War, bearing all kinds of scars from that conflict and experience, which in turn informed the kind of husband and father that he was. And it was the need for him to come to grips with that, and for Anthony to come to grips with that, and for them to rebuild a relationship that was so incredibly dysfunctional and painful. And along the way, there are other struggles for Anthony Swofford as well. And he writes about all of them with disarming honesty and frankness and insight as well. This new memoir, again, is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. The book is a publication of 12 books, and I am very, very honored to be able to speak with the author, Anthony Swofford. Anthony Swofford, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Could you tell me a little bit about how this memoir felt different to write from your first memoir, Jarhead? Because I'm struck by how, in some ways, it sounds like very much the same voice, and yet you are talking about very different things. How different did it feel to write this memoir versus the earlier one?
But it felt quite different. Jarhead being my first book, I spat that one out. I wrote that book in about 8.5 months, 9 months, and I don't think I could write a book that quickly now. That was my first book, and there was some energy and some drive, and I knew that story. And what's different about this new book is that I started it having no idea how it would end. I knew the start point was jumping in this RV with my father on our first trip, and I started writing the book shortly after that trip ended, and I started mining our past. And at that point, I didn't know that there would be two more RV trips, and I didn't really know what my life was going to look like 2.5 years later when I was finishing the book. So in some ways, it was very much a real-time writing of the book. That's not totally true. It's not as though I was in the RV composing. But as I was living the life, I was doing the hard work of pulling it in and having it at the ready when I needed to really narrate it and get it down on the page. And so the practice of writing for this book was a very different practice than with Jarhead.
I want to ask you briefly about the Iowa Writers Workshop. Am I remembering the name of that correctly? I don't want to get it wrong like your father always got it wrong. He called it the Writer's Warehouse, I think.
He did call it the Writer's Warehouse, yeah.
I happen to grow up in Iowa, so I don't want you to misunderstand this question. I love Iowa, and I resent people who misunderstand Iowa's and characterize it in certain ways as just a land of cornfields and so on. That being said, I have to confess that I was sort of amazed at the thought that someone would go to the Iowa Writers Workshop and the books that would result from that would be a book like Jarhead or a book like this one. I mean, hard-hitting, raw, difficult, painful memoirs. When I just imagine the Iowa Writers Workshop in my head, and I'd heard about it before, I just somehow on some stupid level imagine just idyllic books about cornfields, I suppose, ensuing out of that. I mean, it never even dawned on me that at the Iowa Writers Workshop, it would be the real stuff of all kinds of different life stories, including your own.
Yeah, the graduates of the workshop definitely pump out the occasional cornfield book. They're out there. But the great thing about the workshop, well, it's been around since 1935. And American letters of the last century are very much marked by the people who studied there and people who taught there. And it's a multi-variegated place with many voices and many stories coming out of it. I happened to be there in the late 90s, and I was certainly the only of my type at that point. I was this guy who'd been in the Marines, and most of my peers there were, East Coast private school, Ivy College types. And so I was a bit of a fish out of water there, but not really because, I wanted to be a writer. And that's, once you're there, that's really all that matters is your dedication to the craft. When I was there, the great writer Frank Conroy was running the place, and he really loved writers. He cared about teaching, and he wanted to give budding writers a place where they could try anything out and work hard. And his thing was, just you've got to sit in your chair every day for 4 hours and get the work done.
Did you feel self-conscious as the only person of your particular background to be there, or did they do something to make you feel welcome and feel open about sharing what it was that was inside of you?
I was very self-conscious and incredibly so, and didn't really write about the Marine Corps at first, or having been in the Marines. It was the dot-com boom time, and you know, everyone was talking about their buddy who just got a job in Silicon Valley making $300,000 a year, et cetera, et cetera. And that bled into the workshop, too, that kind of that idea of the riches of the dot-com boom. And so when I started writing about the military, there was definitely some sort of open and not hidden disdain for what I was writing about. And people, some of my peers said, "Oh, what are you writing about this war? No, we're not at war. No one even remembers this war. It was not important." That was some of the reaction. But I think the more nuanced thinkers and the people who were bigger thinkers, and certainly my teachers, saw that I was on top of this gold mine of a subject, which was the military and warfare and the internal landscapes of the people who do that fighting, and that was rare there at the time. After World War II, there were a slew of veteran writers who came through Iowa, and after Vietnam, there was a whole slew of veteran writers who came through Iowa. But I was one of the first from the Gulf War.
Mm. This book is mostly about you and your father, although it's certainly about other important relationships in your life, including the relationship with your brother Jeff, who unfortunately died of cancer, your relationship with certain women, with your mother. But it's mostly about your efforts to try to rebuild the fractured relationship with your father. At one point in the book, you write, "No one else will write about my father, so I am his writer. And in the act of writing, I hope to become again his loving son." There's a lot wrapped up in those few words, but one of them is in that first sentence. I mean, what a mantle of responsibility to be the only person who will ever sit down and write something significant about your father. Was that at all a hindrance or, in a sense, an intimidating burden to bear, particularly as you wrote about your father in this memoir?
I don't know that it was a hindrance, but it was certainly, it certainly got in the way sometimes, and it was in my face. I won't kid anyone. There's some dark stuff in this book, and my father was kind of a dark, haunted guy, and he was especially when I was a kid, he was a man I feared. And then when I was an adult, because of some of his behaviors, he was a man I had trouble respecting. But I needed to understand him, and I understand the world and people best when I'm writing and when I'm writing about them. And he was this massive figure. He was in every room I walked into, and he marked me. People are marked by their fathers, and I'm no different. And I was pushing 40, and we'd begun taking these RV trips together, and my father's ill. And some people would say, wait till he passes away and then write about him. But I felt that wouldn't do anyone any service. And I felt an urgency to write about him, and by writing about him, to understand him, and to hopefully, make it a healing act as well. And I remember writing those words that you quoted. I remember exactly where I was when I wrote them. I was in this little writing shed that I have in upstate New York near our house. And when I wrote those words, I think I finally, whatever was in the way, whatever had been in the way in terms of me being able to write about my father, by writing those words, I got rid of them. And I got rid of those hindrances, those blockages. Mm. And and I took on the burden of writing about my father with a new kind of verve and a new kind of clarity.
Ironically, those words appear in the chapter where you are telling us about a bombshell letter. I mean, I mean that in a couple different ways, because you characterize this letter yourself as it was though a bomb went off in your face and left, you know, shredded flesh. It was that painful. Your father had written this over the course of, I think, maybe several years, pouring out a lot of his anger and resentment and frustration and disappointment. And so it's interesting to think about, on the one hand, when he took pen and paper and wrote something, it was venting all this anger. And in the midst of sharing that experience with us of what it felt like to receive this kind of letter from your own father, you're writing about writing in a way that will, you hope, bring the two of you back together again.
Yeah, his letter was explosive. It did. It landed in my mailbox, and I knew what it was. It was heavy enough that I knew exactly what it was. And there's a way in which I've been anticipating this letter for a few years. My brother had received a similar letter at one point with my father, letting him know how displeased he was with him as a son. And I didn't open this letter for a few weeks. I threw it in the top drawer of my desk because I wasn't prepared for it. And then, you know, one night I said, well, okay, here we go. Let's do it. Let's see what the old man says. And, you know, he took me to task, and he had some understandable grievances and some things that were just completely outlandish and ridiculous. And so he, you know, in a way, he wrote me. He chose to write me by writing that letter to me. He wrote a narrative of me. He rendered me in a way that I thought was not really fair. And so then I needed to go in and write him and really, you know, rewrite myself, tell my side of the stories that he tells in that letter. And yeah, my father's a pretty good writer, and he's pretty strong rhetorically, and there's a bit of you know, prose sword rattling that goes on there from the both of us, which I think it will be fascinating for a reader to see and to experience.
I quite agree, and it's certainly a testament to the power of words, and the power of words when they are wielded well, as he does, and as you wield them actually even better in your memoir. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anthony Swofford. You may know that name. I suspect you know that name from his very powerful previous memoir, Jarhead, which stems from his experiences in the Gulf War. His newest memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Your father, as I mentioned earlier, was a Vietnam veteran and came away from that conflict, unfortunately, as so many Vietnam vets did, bearing all kinds of different scars. And that played out certainly in the way kind of husband and father that he was. One thing I find interesting about the way you describe your life growing up with him is that you are careful, I think, in every case to say your father was occasionally abusive, both verbally and physically. But I think every time you mention that, you always use the word occasionally. I wonder how conscious a choice that was. And is it for the reason of pulling back from simply saying he was abusive and maybe painting a picture that you don't want to paint or a picture that would not be fully fair? Can you just talk about that word occasionally?
Yeah, that's a very careful reading on your part, and it's something that I probably hadn't noticed. I don't think that was deliberate. I think, you know, admitting that was difficult. It was difficult for me to write about. It was difficult to out my father as that kind of a father. And also, I guess, you know, once you open that up, then you know, the fear is the die cast. Will I be that same kind of father one day? Which is, you know, another important aspect of the story is me trying to figure out if I have what it takes to be a father. because I love my father, but I do not ever want to be the kind of father that he was. In his good moments, in his moments of love and his moments of good fathering, sure, I can learn some things, but there were many other moments where, you know, he was an abusive guy. I guess I do pull back a little bit, and I probably pull back in order, you know, to protect myself more than anything else.
This is as good a moment as any for me to ask you one thing that I really struggled to understand. At one point, you, I believe, are quoting someone else's book, and now I don't have that exact moment in the book in front of me, but you quote a line, and you even, here it is, from Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I rewrote thousands of times this quote, a good father is not a good father.
Right. I love that quote, and it's something that I try to think about that every day, in fact. I'm thinking about having it tattooed on my body somewhere. I think that Suzuki quote, the essence of that is that, you know, if you decide that you're a good father, you're going to slip and you're not going to be a good father, and that each day you must become a good father again. That's what it means to me. And that each day I will learn what it means to be a good father. When, you know, today my daughter is 9 months old, and to be a good father this morning, you know, was one thing, and to be a good father tomorrow morning will probably be a different thing. And that's the challenge for me as a father.
Your encounters with your father that we read about in this book, I mean, some of it stems from your very difficult childhood, and we'll leave it to our listeners to read about some of the things your father did, and some of the ways he was abusive, and in some of the ways he was simply inattentive in ways that were really painful to you. By the time the events of this book, the present day events, so to speak, roll around, your father has been diagnosed with something called COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. And so this is also the story of your father's precipitous physical decline. And I wonder how significant you think that was in the ultimate reconnection, which does occur to some extent with you and your father, that how much of that had to do with this crushing reality of your father literally losing the ability to breathe. And do you ever wonder about how this time and this reapproachment might have played out differently if your father had remained in robust health?
Yeah, I do. It's the ticking clock of the book. You know, every book needs a ticking clock, and the one here is, you know, will this sick man die? The real life ticking clock for me was like, well, will my father die before we're able to work through this? And the ticking clock in the narrative is the same thing. Is this old guy going to die before his son and he come to some kind of understanding? And it's totally possible that if my father was robust and healthy and had no issues, we never would have gone on these trips, and we would have possibly remained at odds. I have a number of male friends who have fathers who are elderly, and they've never had these conversations. They might have similar problems with their fathers, but their fathers never made the effort to have these deep and difficult conversations. And you know, I have to give my father a lot of credit, because he invited me on that first RV trip, and he's the one who reached out across the cabin in the middle of the night on the first night of driving and said, hey, son, let's have a talk. Let's clear the air.
What's so interesting, I think, is that he reaches across the cab, you tell us, and grabs my forearm and says, Tone, I think we need to get some things out in the open and clear the air. I think you need to get some venom out. And he says that repeatedly. It's such an interesting choice of words. But what you go on to describe is a situation in which your father doesn't seem to really understand what that means. I mean, he doesn't really seem to have much understanding at all of just how deep the venom goes and how much of it is tied up in your father and how he mistreated you. And in a sense, it is this messy, awful can of worms, and he has no idea of what he is potentially opening up. That's one of the most fascinating things to see here.
Yeah, I don't think he knows what he's asking for. You know, when he asks me to get the venom out, which is my father's choice of words, and it was pretty accurate. And he used it again and again over these different trips. And it's as though, you know, he was asking for something and didn't really know the totality of it. And I understand that. I understand that probably when we behave badly, we don't always want to come face to face with the reality of those consequences.
Hmm.
And that was my father there. You know, in a way, I think my father would have preferred that on that first trip when he asked me that I say, "Hey, Dad, you know, I'm beyond it now. It's okay. A, B, C, D, E, F, and G happened, and I'm okay with those things now." Mm. But I really wasn't.
Right. You write at one point, "My father did not want to hear what I had to say. He considered the case closed on most of my grievances, the statute of limitations expired." You also write much later in the book, this might even be I'm pretty sure it must be on another of these RV trips you take together, that your father can't imagine that the rift in our relationship has anything to do with our relationship. He's looking for someone or something to blame. And in this case, as you're struggling through this, money and I are to blame. But in a sense, your father is not really ready to face up to the emotional center of your relationship. And again, it's so interesting to imagine the two of you trying to effect this connection. It really helps us appreciate just how difficult, in fact, that can be.
Yeah, it was very difficult. It was, you know, sometimes it was maddening for me because you know, as you pointed out, my father would ask for something that I don't think he was prepared to completely deal with, and the emotional reality of, you know, what happens when you ask your son to get the venom out, you know, is probably something different than what you were anticipating, and for him it certainly was. And my grievances with him, they ran deep, but they also, you know, you're just, you know, like Faulkner said, you know, the past isn't past, it isn't even over yet. And so when I have my grievances with my father, they would, you know, pass through him into his grievances with him, his father, and into his trauma over his mother dying when he was a month old. And there's reverb, and that stuff comes back to me. It's so complex and fascinating, you know, fathers and sons, and for me as a writer, you know, I was sitting on this relationship, which was the the most troubling relationship I'd ever had. I had to write about it. I had to live it, and I also this had to be, you know, my next book, trying to figure this man out, and then, you know, simultaneously trying to figure myself out.
Right. One of the things you were angriest about with your father is that he did not come to the funeral of your brother, Jeff, who tragically passed away from cancer. Your brother, Jeff, who was a stupendous athlete and very good to you on many, many levels, and to see him waste away and finally be claimed by cancer was, of course, tremendously painful for you, for your whole family, and for your father, who kept his distance, who stayed away from that funeral And that's one of the real linchpins to your rupture. I want to ask you about something you write about your brother, Jeff. I should think this was not easy, that in the wake of his death, one of the things that lingered were all of his lies. For all that you admired about your brother, he told all kinds of lies about himself, all kinds of tall tales about, this and that, wonderful things he had done or accomplished that, in fact, were not true. I wonder if it was painful and difficult for you to share this part of the story of your brother, Jeff.
Extremely so. As a kid, my brother was my hero, and he was a great brother. He was a lovely, lovely guy, and he was kind of a compulsive liar. He told lies about things he'd done and places he'd been, and when I realized that, and then when I was sitting down working on it and writing about it. It saddened me deeply because he was a great guy, and he didn't need to tell lies about, playing an exhibition game with the San Francisco 49ers, or the list goes on. And I felt, what was sad was thinking that he must have felt like whatever he was doing wasn't good enough, and so he needed to create these alternative stories of who he was, and that saddened me because I think who he was perfectly fine, and that he should have been happy with who he was, and he should have lived in his life rather than fabricating these other lives, and that realization was extremely sad.
Absolutely. You write, the man dies, his deeds remain, and so too his lies.
Yeah.
Back to the very beginning of the book, you write, I believed there existed no grander test for a man than combat. Every other pursuit was pure, unimportant leisure when compared to a firefight. I suspect that you maybe do not believe that, at least to the same extent. Do you see other tests of a man that are nearly as powerful as those in combat?
I do. I see fatherhood as now the ultimate test. I think that was a young man's view and a young man's romance with combat and what it would mean and what it could mean. But now I'm a father, and that will be my test is whether or not I'm a good father, and what kind of fathering I do to my daughter, what kind of husband I am. Those are the tests and the ones that that I want to pass day to day. And I had that realization. It landed on me with a lot of clarity, a true epiphanous moment on the day that my daughter was born, and she was sitting on my chest, and she was this new life and this new reality for me, and I experienced this psychological lightness, like so many anxieties about being a writer, being a son, whatever else I was in the world, just kind of disappeared, and I thought, well, this is it. I'm a father now, and the most important thing that I'll do is father this little girl, and I welcomed that clarity, and I love now having that clarity and that meaning, which is now my life's work.
This new book again is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir published by 12 Books and written by Anthony Swofford. Anthony Swofford, thank you for writing this really powerful, unforgettable book, and I so appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about it today. Thank you.
Thanks for your time, Greg. Thank you very much.
Monday on the morning show, we're going to do something very special and pay memorial tribute to Frank Germanaro, who passed away. We're going to be replaying a memorable conversation recorded with him and his wife, Janet, on the occasion of the 40th anniversary.